I've been poking around inside my Steam Deck this week.
You were, missus. Did you break it?
It wasn't in great shape.
Oh.
I'm not sure exactly what I did, but sometime near when I got it, I must have spilled something on it. I have a vague memory of very, very briefly spilling something on it, wiping it off and thinking, ah, be fine.
Had you been drinking sherry at the time?
Something similar, perhaps. Certainly something a bit sticky. So maybe some sort of carbonated beverage or similar.
It's a good job this isn't a video podcast, because the looks on mine and Martin's faces as you've been describing this is not pretty.
Yeah. So the upshot of this was, I realised a couple of months ago, as I was playing a game and I pressed in my right trackpad, it made the most cringeworthy squelching noise and would get stuck and would, you know, you'd end up with whatever button was bound to that permanently on, and it just got to the point where I just did not want to touch it for fear of what would happen.
This is super grim. This is, yeah. I'm hoping for a very happy outcome at the end of this.
This sounds expensive.
Yeah.
Yeah. So because I've been playing a game not with my Steam Deck, I've actually been playing Breath of the Wild on the Nintendo Switch, which isn't relevant to this podcast. So that means that my Steam Deck is out of action for a while. So I thought this is the perfect time to open it up and see if there's something I can do about it. So I bought a repair kit from iFixit, because they've got loads of guides about opening up and replacing parts in the Steam Deck. And they have a guide for how to replace the right trackpad. Now, I was hoping that I wouldn't actually have to replace the trackpad. I would just be able to have a look and see what was going on. So I followed the steps. It was actually really good and really satisfying just to do the dismantling, because it's really well put together. The guide is excellent and everything's really well engineered so that you can do this.
Yeah. I mean, this was one of the early sort of features of the Steam Deck, you know, before they were reviewed and before they were out in the wild. They made quite the sort of play for, we're taking this right to repair and serviceability very seriously with the Steam Deck. And I think they released their own sort of teardown video.
It was a bit of a funny one. It was like, here's how easy it is to do, don't do this.
Yeah.
And then iFixit got a bit grumpy about that with them. And I think they're a bit better about it now. So the first thing I discovered was the Steam Deck has this thing called battery storage mode, where if you are not going to use it for a while, or if you're going to open it up and start poking inside, it can basically put it in super, super low power mode where it won't turn on at all unless you plug in the charger. So that's the first thing I did. I went into the sort of bootloader menu and put it into that. Took the back off, which was a few screws, and then slide in an opening pick around sort of where the trigger is to get in around the edge. And once you go down one edge, the whole back pops off nice and easily. Unplugging the battery, I found, was a bit fiddly because everything's very tightly packed. There's no slack on any of the cables at all. But what they do have is they've each got a nice little tab that sticks out from the cable. And so you've got something to pull on with all of them, and, you know, various tools in the right places, and everything came apart.
Plus, you've got a video guide telling you exactly how to unplug each of these cables, I imagine.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. Well, at least photos show you what's where and what you need to do.
So at this point where you've got cables exposed and you can see there's little to no wiggle room, how are your stress levels at this point now you've sort of got the thing open?
It was a bit fiddly and a bit stressful, I will admit. I mean, it's really interesting seeing inside compared to like a phone or a laptop, because it's quite a thick device and there's layers to it as you go down. It's like a bit of a lasagna of PCBs in there. So I think I actually, to get from the back of the machine to the touchpad at the front, I think I had to take off four PCBs, which were layered up.
Wow.
Each with its own set of screws. And also a lot of them are mounted. There's like little plastic posts mounted on a corner.
That's always a worry.
Exactly. So you unscrew everything, you're like, great. And then you pick it up and you're like, oh, that's not coming. And so you have to try and lever it so it's coming out flat and you're not going to snap the post. But I did eventually manage to get around it. And I think I found on a board that the teardown guide describes as the button board, I found there was some corrosion around one of the connectors.
Yikes.
Which was my first sign of trouble, and a sort of streak of some sort of liquid across the board. But considering that, it hadn't caused any kind of other noticeable electrical problems. It had just obviously been sitting there for a while. So I managed to take that out, and I cleaned that up with some isopropyl alcohol. and managed to get it looking all nice. And then I kept going down, and what I found was you've got the touchpad, which is mounted on two springs, and then behind that you've got a board, which it, I guess there's a sensor in there for how much it's pressed against it or something, as well as the capacitive sensor in the touchpad itself.
And this is the origin of the squelch.
Yes, there was basically a blob of sticky goo. Oh,
lasagna, no. Probably.
Yeah, it was sort of dried on, but it was just sitting on the sensor. And so it was quite obvious that that's what was happening. I had to take it apart and clean it and then put it back together a few times. There was also sort of, once you'd taken the touchpad off, around the rim of the case where it sits, there was also some residue around there. What I was a bit worried about was the springs. I was assuming that they'd got gummed up with something, but they were absolutely fine. But it does warn you in the guide, they're quite sort of sensitive. So I had to be really careful with them. You can feel they give quite easily. And it did make it quite difficult putting it back together and trying to tell if it was the same as the one I hadn't dismantled.
Right.
Because until you've got it back on and you've got the haptics on, it doesn't really feel how it's going to feel.
Right.
So I had to sort of make sure that it wasn't sticking, make sure it felt about right, and then just, you know, put it back together and hope. And it worked. Once I got it, it took a good while getting it properly clean and put it all back together by just reversing exactly what I'd done. And yeah, it went really well.
You say a good while. What sort of duration?
I probably spent probably about 10 minutes sort of cleaning just into, you know, we're talking about a sort of postage stamp size area of board. So, you know, just reapplying the cleaning fluid and scrubbing it off, making sure it was dry, seeing if there was anything left, see if there was anything else around.
And you mentioned earlier that the cables are sort of made to measure.
Yeah.
Did you have any difficulty reconnecting those during the reassembly?
It wasn't as bad as I was expecting. There was a few tricky bits where you have to, you know, you have something that comes up around the board and then into a connector, and you've got to make sure you lay everything in exactly the right place before you put the board in place. What was actually trickier was what I did next, which was I then went on to replace the fan.
Oh, right.
Oh.
Because I thought while I was in there, I'd also ordered a replacement fan because mine was one of the noisy fans. If you're familiar with reviews of the Steam Deck, some of them have an okay fan and some of them have a noisy fan. And I was unlucky enough to get the noisy one. So once I put all that back together, remove a couple of screws on the fan itself. There's then, for some reason, a sticker holding the fan to the heatsink, which was a bit of a suboptimal choice for a home repair, because then you've got to very carefully unstick this sticker without it tearing, which I did manage. But reattaching the cable once I'd put the new fan in was actually the fiddliest bit of the whole thing, because it's a really small connector. And
they're
again,
small at the best of times.
Exactly. Yeah. Very little slack. So yeah, getting that around and getting it in without pulling anything too much was a bit tricky, but that has made the world of difference. It's gone from whine to what I would best describe as a loud whisper.
Right.
Certainly not silent. Anyone who tells you any fan is silent is just lying.
Yeah, mine makes a kind of whooshing noise.
Yeah, you've probably got the good one then. Yeah, I'd say it's like,
right.
I won't try and imitate it now because our listeners don't want to hear that.
Yeah. Fan noise is more about the tone than anything, isn't it?
It's exactly,
whether you find it tolerable or not.
More importantly, whether my partner sitting next to me on the sofa in the evening finds it tolerable, because I can just put headphones on.
So all in all, the whole process of you buying stuff, you said you got it from iFixit. Did that have to come from the States or did it come from Europe? Was there import tax and stuff or anything?
No, all the tax and stuff was sorted, I think. But yeah, I think it shipped from Europe. Was the impression I got. It took about a week to arrive.
Do you mind me asking how much it cost for, how much you spent for the fan and the replacement touchpad or whatever it's called?
So I didn't get a replacement touchpad. I just cleaned,
you just cleaned the existing one, right.
Yeah. So the fan, they sell it either by itself or with a kit with just the tools you need to go in and do it. I think the fan itself is about £20 and with the kit, it's about £25-30. But I just bought the fan and I bought a separate larger kit because I knew I needed a couple of extra bits to go all the way in and do the touchpad, and I wanted some more tools. So I think the kit as well was somewhere in the region of £40-50.
So having gone through a repair of the Steam Deck, a repair and a, let's call it an upgrade, how do you feel that Valve have done in terms of their sort of mission to make a serviceable, repairable device?
I would say extremely well. I mean, considering how packed together everything is in there and how the tolerances they were working with to try and make sure that everything was just so in terms of the power and the heat dissipation and everything that they were trying to do in that. Also managing to make it so that it, you know, someone like me can just take bits out and put them back in and it all works is, yeah, I think they've done a really good job of it. And also a big shout out to iFixit, who their tools are really good and the guides are really good there as well.
I'm super concerned about doing something like this. I hold my my Steam Deck with kid gloves and I'm very delicate with it because I know if something went wrong, I'm such a ham-fisted oaf that I would break it if I took it apart. And I have, you know, taken phones and other devices apart before to fix them or replace batteries or screens and stuff and completely messed it up and ended up junking the thing because I couldn't, you know, and this precious device, this precious, precious gaming device, I don't want to muck it up. So the fact that you've said it is actually pretty straightforward for someone like yourself to take apart is good news.
Yes. And to be honest, if I hadn't already mucked it up, I wouldn't have been attempting this. It was basically, this was the least bad option. Right. It's like, I knew that I had to at least know what was going on in there. I couldn't carry on playing it with this going on.
I think I've been taking digital hoarding a little bit too far. I discovered an application called Tube Archivist last week on Hacker News, and it's a handy tool for archiving YouTube channels.
What do you mean? Like, as in downloading the whole thing?
Yes, exactly that. And, you know, there are already tools like YouTube DL and YouTube DLP and stuff like that, that can download individual videos and playlists, and you can point them at like lists of URLs and stuff. Those things do exist. But this is a nice web-based application. I think it's a Django application under the covers that has a nice pretty front end where you can point it at a YouTube channel and download it for archival purposes. So for example, if you're a popular YouTuber and you make videos and you push them to YouTube, or you do live streams and they're archived on YouTube, at some point, Google might say goodbye and close down your channel, or they might shut down YouTube, or any one of a number of reasons, copyright strikes or whatever, might mean that your videos go away or access to your videos go away. And so the goal of this project is to allow people to archive their own YouTube channels onto their own machine. But there's other things you can do with it as well. And so I installed it and tested it out, and it works.
So you say it's a Django application. So my mind's immediately thinking this is some sort of a pretty web application. So does this mean you get something that looks like a YouTube channel that you can look at in your web browser, or does it just sort of dump all of the thumbnails and videos and some text metadata and stuff?
Why not both? Yes, it does all of that.
Oh.
So the way it works is you install it on a machine. I chucked it on my trusty home server running Ubuntu 22.04, I think. And once it's installed, which is pretty straightforward, the instructions just work. I used Docker. I'm not a fan of Docker at all, but I happen to have Docker installed on that machine and the instructions worked. So I thought, okay, well, that's fine. Once you have it running, you can point your browser at it. And yes, you get a web UI in which you feed it a channel URL, like any YouTube channel URL, and it then can go and grub through that channel, find all of the videos, gather all the thumbnails, all the descriptions, the durations, the likes, and optionally, you can also gather the dislikes and all of that kind of metadata about the video that you would care about if you wanted to archive your own videos. You might want to know that kind of stuff. And then you can schedule downloads of the actual videos. It doesn't do it automatically straight away. You have to tell it to download the videos. And then it'll just go through creating a list of videos to download, and it will chug through them, downloading them all to a directory that you specify in the config. And the second part of your question, so the first part, yes, it does download them all and creates all these metadata files, and you've got a cache of MP4s that are easily understandable. There's a folder with your channel name, and in there is a bunch of MP4s, and the file format is date stamp underscore name of video description, like the title of the video underscore, and then the YouTube ID of the video .mp4. It's pretty straightforward. It's quite nicely done. But then there's a web UI where you can actually look at all the videos in that channel and search as well. So you can search for keywords. If you know you did a video on a particular topic, you can find that video in your archive, and there's a video player as well. So you can just click it and it'll pop the video up directly off of your own storage locally, offline. If you wanted to archive your videos and be able to watch them offline, you can totally do that.
That's really nice.
So I could host my own version, my own archive of my YouTube channel. I could have a videoarchive.something.com.
I'm not sure you would do that.
Okay.
For bandwidth and hosting, you know, consumption reasons. It's not really designed, as far as I can tell, for public access. You can, it's got an admin interface where you can create multiple users. So if there's you and a bunch of friends who want to also access this resource, you can give them all user IDs and accounts where they can log in and they can see the video archive as well.
Right.
I don't think it's really designed for being a public way of mirroring your YouTube videos. Okay. It's more for your personal archival data hoarding purposes.
Yeah. And did you need any sort of authentication keys or API keys in order to do this, or is that optional?
Yes and no. No, I didn't need any keys because it uses YouTube DLP and other public APIs to get the names of the videos and the thumbnails. Those are all public APIs and you don't need an API key for that. But I mentioned that it can go and get the downvote from videos. Now that gets hidden by the YouTube API by default, but there is an application, I think it's called Restore Downvote or something like that. And they have an API. And so if you get an API key, you could put that in. That is optional.
Right.
I don't particularly care about that, but that is something you could do. Yes. And the configuration is pretty straightforward. Once it's installed, there's a config screen in the web UI where you can tell it when you want to periodically check. So if you're constantly doing live streams and you've got videos going on in your YouTube archive, then maybe you want to overnight download those into your archive locally. I get this is a pretty niche use case, but that's what it was designed for.
Yeah.
There are other use cases for it though.
Such as?
Well, you could point it at someone else's YouTube channel. You don't have to archive your own.
Right.
So, for example, I'm pointed it at your YouTube channel as a test to see if it would work. And sure enough, it downloaded every video in your channel on YouTube. And that amounts to 74 gigabytes of disk space on my server. You're welcome. And I also downloaded my own, which amounts to just 30 gig of space. I did that as a test to see, you know, if it works. And it presents a user interface where you can sort by various things, but most recently downloaded is useful. Mm. It's a bit like the subscriber page on YouTube itself. It shows you the most recent videos at the top. And so if you did have this chugging away in the background, downloading a couple of channels, then when you visit the page, you're going to see the most recent videos at the top. And if you've already watched them on YouTube, you can mark them as already viewed and it'll hide them.
Right.
Or you could just click through and watch them in a video player that appears in your browser window. It's quite neat.
It does sound very useful. And is there any way, if you've got your own channel, can you coerce it to get your unlisted and private videos as well? Or is it purely what is ever publicly available?
I don't know that it'll do that.
Okay.
I don't see anywhere in the config where you can tell it to get private stuff or unlisted stuff. No, it only showed me public videos.
Interesting.
Which, you know, makes sense. I don't know, if you gave it a playlist, you can feed it a playlist as well, or individual video URLs. So it could get them if they were unlisted, but not if they're private, obviously, because it doesn't have any API access to that.
Right.
The other thing it can do is if you already have an archive of the videos, if you've already downloaded a channel, you can import them. It's got like an import process to save you re-downloading them all over again. Like if you already used some other tool to archive your channel, you could import the videos in, which is quite neat as well.
And is that just from a folder of MP4 files?
Yeah, and you can also specify the metadata in a little file that goes alongside it. So if you want to have all the titles and all of that kind of stuff, rather than just raw videos in there. Yeah. But yeah, it's pretty neat. It is a bit niche, But I thought it would be quite handy, you know, if I ever did forget my YouTube channel exists and my Google account gets shut down and goes away and I care about those videos, then I can be sure I've got a copy on my server.
And potentially re-upload them to a new channel.
Yeah, yeah. Or even just like keep them for myself as a nice memory of me shouting at a robot, "What are beans?"
I have created a magical LAN using the internet.
Okay.
So I'm going to be talking about a bit of software called Zero Tier, and I suspect that everything I say is probably possible with Tailscale, but I don't know for sure because I haven't used Tailscale to the same extent. So I suppose I should start by explaining what Tailscale and Zero Tier are. And from this point onwards, I'm just going to talk about Zero Tier because this is the thing that I've really been tinkering with. So it's at its heart a VPN, but it's a VPN of your own between your own devices. So it's not one of these, I'm not going to say any brand names, but let's just say license violating, copyright violating services, you know, which is ostensibly how these VPN services are marketed these days.
Right.
This is a VPN for you to be able to connect from a machine that you're on, maybe my laptop, to my home server without having to configure anything on my router. And this is the magical part about it. So you don't have to open any ports on your firewall. You don't have to run any port address translation or static IP addresses. And in fact, it is completely magical. And I'll explain some of the magical properties. Now, there may be some people listening to this who are zoning out thinking, "Oh, I've heard about this Tailscale and Zero Tier's filling a similar niche. And oh, this is not for me. You know, I'm a home user enthusiast. I don't need these enterprise tools." Well, I'm here to tell you, I've found loads of ways to use this that I think everyone who's a little bit nerdy with computers and networks will absolutely love.
Okay, I'm listening.
I'm going to go through some of what I've done. So the first thing is, so I've used Tailscale, and the only thing I've used it for in the past is being able to connect to servers at work.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I've used it for. But I was using it for my own stuff, but work use Tailscale. So I had to use my Tailscale instances on my hosts in order to be part of the work network. But I needed a way to persist my own way of connecting to all of my devices. So this is why I started using Zero Tier alongside Tailscale.
Sorry, for the confused, I'm asking on behalf of a confused person. You're saying this because you've already got a Tailscale setup, which is connecting to work, and you want to connect to other systems that you own on other locations, but you can't have two Tailscales at the same time. Is that what you're basically saying?
Exactly what I'm saying, yes. Ah,
right, okay.
Yes. Now, what you can have is multiple Zero Tiers at the same time. Now, I haven't done that because I haven't needed to. So I will explain some scenarios where I have used Zero Tier. So the simplest is I have an office here at home, which I'm talking to you from now, with a workstation. And I have another office in town with another workstation. That office in town is a co-location, co-working space. I have no jurisdiction over the firewalls or the networks or anything like that. And in fact, my PC there is connected to a Wi-Fi network. Every host is isolated. It's all locked down. But I am able to SSH from here to that workstation over an IP address, which is a 192.168 local area network address. And I can just connect from here to there and from there to here. And its magical property is it figures out how to punch holes in all of the right places in order to make those connections happen.
You said there's no public IP with a public open port, so other people can't port scan that machine inside that office.
Correct.
Right. Okay.
That was really useful for me because it meant that I could, for example, the next way that I'm using this is once I'd figured out I could connect to my work machine in this way, in this secure network environment, there are times when I take my laptop to that office, but I can't SSH to my workstation on that Wi-Fi network because all the hosts are isolated from one another. Well, this solves that problem as well because now all of my computers are on this LAN. I have a 192.168.192 subnet that is mine on zero tier. And not only is it looks like and operates like a regular LAN, it also has broadcast addresses. You can define routes. So I'm able to route from my zero tier LAN to my home LAN. So from anywhere in the world, from my laptop, I can connect to my home router to log into the management network interfaces, but at no point have I connected to any IP addresses or ports that are exposed to the internet.
So is this happening peer-to-peer between your devices, or does zero tier have some sort of, I'm going to call it a router, for want of a better term, sitting on their server somewhere, which everything goes between?
So that is an excellent question. The first part of the answer is zero tier do operate a little bit of infrastructure, but you can self-host that bit of infrastructure if you want.
Right. But that would have to be publicly available, presumably.
That has to be publicly available. And what that piece does is when you install zero tier on your computer, you tell it which network ID to connect to. So think short hash network ID. You just tell everything, this is my network name, and they will attempt to connect, but you have to authorize each device. So you log into their little admin panel. You look at the device ID on the computer that you've just installed the software on. You see the device ID unauthenticated. You tick the I authenticate this device box, and it provisions that device and IP address on your magical LAN. And at that point, the zero tier infrastructure is not used or required. It creates a peer-to-peer mesh VPN. And when I say it's a LAN, it really is. Broadcast addressing works. So one of the things that I'm using it for, and this works particularly well, is I have SyncThing on this workstation and SyncThing on the workstation in the remote office. And because they are now on the same LAN, I don't need to use the global discovery servers. They actually see each other via Avahi as partners on the same LAN.
Nice.
So when I say share this folder or add this device, it happens instantly. There's no waiting around. All of this stuff is just instantaneous.
You could use KD Connect to push stuff from your phone, couldn't you?
You could.
If it thinks it's on the same LAN.
Now your cogs are moving about what you could use this for. I will give you some other ideas of ways that I've used this. So last episode, I spoke about Martin as a service with this immutable NixOS that I've given a few family members and how they call me when they need assistance. Well, when they call me, I can connect to their computers from anywhere using zero tier in order to do whatever I might need doing. So that's one use case. And I've just talked about SyncThing there. A few weeks ago, we had a long weekend away and we stayed in a hotel that has free but crippled Wi-Fi, where they try to upsell you because you can't connect to premium services like Netflix, for example. So I installed the zero tier app on the phones and the tablets. Those are then on the LAN at home and connect to the Plex server, and without having to pay for elevated Wi-Fi, we are able to access our Plex server and watch the stuff from our home Plex instance.
You could also access your home Tube archivist if you had one.
Yeah, and there is so much that you can do with this, because now in this world where I'd never need any ports exposed to the outside world, I have a static IP, or in fact, I have a small range of static IP addresses on my router, which I pay extra for. I don't need that anymore. Because the only reason I had that was as a sort of a robust way to always be able to connect to stuff at home. But now I have this LAN that is pervasive and everywhere.
So the big important question, how much does it cost?
So I'm using the free tier, which gives you one administrator and up to 25 devices. For the next tier up, it's, I think, $25 a month or something like that. So to get started with it, it's free. The source is available. They use what they call a business source license, but all of the source code is on GitHub. You can see it all. So it's a fairly open solution. It has a facility where you can run a DNS server on your magical LAN. So you can even operate that infrastructure in a very sensible way with predictable names and all the rest of it. I'm in the throes of using it as a means to do reciprocal offsite backups with family members over sync thing. So we are now connected in order to shuffle data backwards and forwards between our various machines. And here's the killer feature. Alan and I have had several goes round at trying to figure out how to play local network player retro games from our two houses. Well, this is the solution because it's all on a LAN. So maybe you've got games, dear listener, that are local network multiplayer only. Well, now those games are internet multiplayer games with your friends. And in fact, Zero Tier talk quite a lot in the use cases. People have been using it for years to solve this multiplayer over the LAN problem.
What's the latency and speed like?
As best as I can tell, it's kind of linked to the quality of your connection.
Right.
So the office is a gig symmetrical. And here I've got fiber and I've got 1 gig down and I think 65 up. And the latency between those two sites is 80 to 100 milliseconds. So there is some latency, but I think it's workable. And what I'm really wondering is could you use Steam Remote Play over such a network? Because this client is available for everything. And I can install Nix on a Steam Deck, and I can install Zero Tier via Nix. So I could put a Steam Deck on my magical LAN and then connect to my games machine at home from anywhere in the world.
Interesting. I'm going to have a play with this.
Yes. I have ideas.
I look forward to hearing how you've put Zero Tier to good use in the future.